Hello, good evening. How are you?
I'm excited, very excited. It's Wednesday night. We've got an amazing guest.
Yep, we have indeed. Our guest this evening has spent 38 years in hospitality.
88?
38 years in the hospitality industry.
Wow.
He first came to Dubai in about 2006, leading the charge working for Atlantis before it came online in 2008. As the FP of culinary, and after quite a few years, he ended up as the SVP and managing and running 23 restaurants for the Atlantis Hotel. He's worked all over the world. He's worked at Sandy Lane in Barbados. He's worked for Harrods in London, looking at all of their restaurants, which I'm sure he's going to tell us about. His name is Mark Patton, a.k.a. Chefy, a.k.a. Paddo. Welcome, mate. Nice to see you.
Yeah, great to see you, lads.
Welcome, mate. Welcome Captain, to the Captain's Table.
Captain Rex, thank you very much. I'm honoured to be part of this, and thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, we're excited to have you here because we know there's going to be some great stories and to hear a lot more about it.
High expectations indeed, Hammond.
No pressure.
So I think basically what we try and do is we have a focus on Dubai, which keeps it local and of interest to people. But, you know, what we try and do is get a bit of a tab on, you know, your background and how it all started and where you came from and everything. So if you could just kind of give us a little inkling about when you started off in Australia all those years ago, and we'll take it from there.
Yeah, guys, it's been a great journey, and I wouldn't have changed anything. You know, they say, you know, what would you do if you weren't doing what you were doing? And besides riding a horse, I don't think there's anything else I'd rather do. I love F&B. Started as a young lad, you know, had great grandparents that lived in a little town in called Broken Hill in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
Spent a lot of time with them, and they used to love to cook. You know, when you've got grandparents that love to cook, it just sticks with you. When those food, the flavours, they were Maltese immigrants into Australia after the Second World War, and they just loved everything about food. They were self-sufficient. They lived in the middle of the desert. And if you know Broken Hill, remember those Mad Max movies, that's where it was all filmed.
Shout out to Broken Hill. We've got a couple of guests from there, so a couple of listeners. So,
I tell you what, I spent most of my young childhood holiday days there, although I grew up in Melbourne, but those 14-hour Greyhound bus trips all the way up the city, Silver City Highway was were memorable as a young lad. And look, I started cooking as young, you know, I was 14, 15 years of age, started the MCG.
Wow. That was your first,
wow. That was
first
my
apprentice
first,
job? Or,
yeah,
wow.
First year apprentice, MCG, when Gary Packer put the lights on for that great Benson and Hedges triangular series against those amazing West Indies back in the days. And then, look, I just continued to cook. I stayed in Melbourne and learned my trade. And then from there, moved up to a fabulous resort called Hayman Island, which was 10 nautical miles out of the Great Barrier Reef.
Far North Queensland.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was a young chef de cuisine, I think about 22 years of age. Started in sort of more senior management.
Mm-hmm.
And look, it sort of just evolved very quickly. You know, back then, I think we were cooking, it was really interesting to cook crocodile, kangaroo, and all these native spices that we had in under our disposal, and it was a lot of fun. We were running the number one resort in the world at that time.
Wow.
It was, you know, voted by Condé Nast and Travel and Leisure as the number one resort, owned by Ansett Airlines. You know, look, it was fantastic. They sent me abroad a few times, Norway and England, to do food promotions and promote
For Australian food?
For Australian food and to promote the island.
Yeah, right.
It was a great experience. I was a young lad. I was only 23, 24 years of age.
And what did you have to take the food out with you?
Yeah, we were shipping kangaroo and crocodile and emu and wallaby and, you know, all the native spices, lemon aspen and rosella and, you know, all these beautiful, you know, wild berries and spices.
And it was very well received, I think you were saying.
Oh, actually, Norway was a huge hit. I mean,
yeah.
We had to extend a little bit. Then, you know, halfway through the trip to Bergen, I ran out of kangaroo. So we had to call,
as you do.
So we had to call for another couple of hundred kilo. By the time we got to Oslo, I ran out of it again. So
Right. Then
we got to Copenhagen, and by then, kangaroo was a big hit. I mean, when you get to eat reindeer, and you just have reindeer, and then all of a sudden this another lean animal comes on your table, you think, wow, tastes like reindeer. but it's kangaroo. So it was actually a big hit. And, you know, we just had we had a lot of fun doing it. And from there, I left Australia in, I think it was 96, and I moved to England and was very fortunate to work with quite a unique property called the Hempel. It was a small boutique hotel.
Yes, absolutely.
Anushka Hempel, 40 rooms, all designed differently. It was a great experience. And after London, I moved to join the Foreign Minister of Cyprus, Elekos Michalidis, to open the Anassa out in the north coast of Cyprus, which was the five-star property on the island. And it was a fantastic experience. You know, I was in quite a rural area on the island. A majority of the team only spoke Cypriot, so I had to learn quite quickly the language. I had a great team. Actually, one of my chefs in the operation is the famous Colin Clay, who opened Zuma here.
Right. Okay. Yep.
Had Roya.
Mm-hmm.
So, and at the same time, our baker and pastry chef was none other than Paul Hollywood, who was the great big baker.
Right,
actually, I bought Paul's motorbike off him, and we had lots of fun out there in Cyprus in the time.
And so, how long did you spend out there?
Oh, it was a couple of years, and then I cooked for some great guests, and I went out, and you go back in the day, you always engage with the customer, so the chef was never like left out the back just cooking. You had to come out, like being Australian, growing up in a great resort, being involved in that level of cuisine and hospitality as we were back in Australia during that period.
Mm.
We brought that sort of whole philosophy of engaging with your customer. So I remember a group of guests coming to the Anassa, and I went out and a big Irish group, and I heard a few names bantering around, and I didn't realise who they were. And a couple of weeks later, I get a phone call from a PA of a gentleman called Dermot Desmond, the owner at Celtic Football Club. And Mr. Desmond would like to talk to you. He had such a great birthday party and holiday down in your resort, and would like to talk to you about a possibility of coming over and joining them to open and reopen Sandy Lane in Barbados.
Right, which of course is the fabulous place, and it was world renowned, right?
Yeah, it was the Forte Hotel back in the day, and it was like the grand arm of resorts in the world. You know, it's where everybody, they flew in the Concorde, and they dressed up every night, and it was all very, very, very glamorous. You know, a beautiful coral stone property with only 105 keys. And Dermot and the group, David Manis down at Ladbrokes, they all bought the property, and they renovated, completely rebuilt from scratch. And I was hired as the culinary director in 1999, and I spent 4.5 years out there running the business, which was probably to today one of the greatest experiences as a young guy. But at the same time, coming from a very small, obviously small environment, Melbourne's not very big. It only had a small amount of five-star hotels and restaurants, but growing up in places like Broken Hill, and then all of a sudden being in this environment, I think what really connected to me was that first time and when they put me in square leg at the MCG, and the amazing West Indies cricket team walked in, and there I was serving food to the likes of Big Bird, Joel Garner, and Desi Haynes, and Gordon Greenidge, and Keith Lloyd, and Michael Holding, and watching the legends of cricket walk through, and I'm going, wow, I've got a really good job here.
Yeah.
I mean, you grow up as a young kid and you just love cricket, right? That's all you think about, and besides footy, and your team. And then, there I was in Barbados, and my next-door neighbour was Desi Haynes.
Wow.
Guy across the road, two doors down, was Gordon Greenidge. Around the corner was Big Bird, Joel Garner. And I was playing golf. I got a chance to play with Sir Garfield Sobers, and so playing golf, with the likes of, these amazing, like, cricketers that, as a young lad, I was, like, idolising.
Absolutely.
So, and Sandy Lane being 105 keys, amazing property. We had the likes of everyone from Sidney Crawford to Simon Cowell to Sir Alex Ferguson, you name it. Everybody came and stayed it was, and you know, I was the host, I was culinary director, so I had to go and meet every guest every day, talk to them, Cilla Black, you know, John Cleese, wow, you know, the Stones, Brian Ferry, we were there, and it was great, you know, it was just like, it was just a great experience, and it was, I think, you know, when I look back at it, it was something that, you know, sort of it builds, I think, an experience or a character to deal with many different sort of type of clientele as well, you know, especially when you're looking at, you always think, you know, Captain Rex, you know, think that those, the customers that you think that are going to be the most difficult, actually not. They're the ones that actually, they're
quite easy.
Quite amazing. I mean, you look, the Concorde used to fly in back then every Saturday morning, come out of supersonic, and we'd stand outside at 9:45 and you'd hear the boom, boom, and then, you know, you'd stand, everyone would stand outside just to wave at the Concorde as passing by, and the nose would dip, the pilot would dip the nose because everyone on board was coming to Sandy Lane. Even, you know, 90%.
So the normal stay would be a week or 2 weeks?
No,
or?
Generally they were coming out for about 6 to 7 to 8 weeks. So they would come out for a long time. The keys were actually given to certain people, so certain individuals who had certain rooms. And then if you didn't, and they would have them for the season and then between.
Right.
So, you know, you'd have the likes of, you know, everyone from Chris Rea to, you know, would have, you know, we'd stay all the time, you know, 6-8 weeks. And fabulous, you know, yeah. Simon Cowell would come and stay for months at a time.
Lucky him.
Yeah. This is just as before American Idol started. So, okay. You know. Michael Flatley used to call me on the phone and ask me to make him some burgers as he got off.
He's not shy of a few bob either, is he?
It's quite funny, actually, Rexy, because you know, I used to package them up, put them in the pink bag, and walk outside, and the Bentley Red Line would come through, and I'd say, "Hi, Michael, welcome to home." And he'd have his house up at Sandy Lane, and I'd hand the bag through the window. Oh, it was the most expensive drive-through McDonald's in the world, I think.
Brilliant.
You know, I was charged about 50 quid a burger. Now it's a good burger. He loved it.
Was it a very American kind of looking menu, or was it truly international? What was the – where were you coming? European.
Very European and very, very high quality. I mean, we had to have – you know, I think the chef de cuisine I had upstairs in Lacajou was the runner-up in Bocuse d'Or in 99, which is like the culinary competition, like the professional culinary competition. I mean, we had some really big heavy hitters in the operation, and we had to produce, you know, it was top quality.
A lot of lobster.
It wasn't always that. It was just you know, what we get locally from the fish markets. We had it. We're an island, so we try to use as much locally as possible. But, you know, you had to bring in your foie gras, you had to bring
in caviar, you had to
bring in all that top quality experience for the customer. So after Barbados, you know, I thought that it was a great idea to spend some time back in Asia. So I joined a rebranding of the Regent Hotel in Hong Kong, which is the one in front of the peninsula, again, a very famous property.
Mm-hmm.
Ran that property for a few years and then moved to Singapore, where I headed up a regional role for Shangri-La Hotels, based in the original first Shangri-La property in Orange Grove Road, 1,100 rooms. Was a fabulous property. Looked after regional for Southeast Asia, Malaysia, Thailand, Chiang Mai, open properties with Shangri-La. We had some really successful years. And at that point in time, you know, the phone rings and there I'm talking to the president of Atlantis asking me to come out and come to Dubai. I'd heard of the property.
Yeah. Is this Sol Kerzner himself or
no,
was
Alan,
one of his guys?
It was Alan Lieben, president. So, and then I went to London, I met with Alan and Sol, and then I came out to Dubai. And
in the lead up to its opening?
Well, it was only 2006.
So it was a good year or something.
I landed in 2007, so it was a good year before we opened.
Right.
Okay. But you needed to, you know. I mean, you know, we had to hire just in the kitchen about 560 in the team. We had 23 restaurants to open on the one day. But we also had two parts to consider. Was the grand opening. which was in November of 2008.
Mm-hmm.
So you had the grand opening party with Kylie. You know, we had a sit-down dinner for 4,500 people, so we had to build two marquees and build over the whole pool. And it was a three-day event, and the whole Palm was closed down. So you, logistically, we were working on two areas. We were working on the grand opening party, which was a 3 or 4 day event, which was with fireworks, et cetera, et cetera. And we had the actual opening of the hotel, which I believe was 24th of September 2008. We opened all the restaurants on the same day. So it was an amazing experience. Look, it was sort of a combination of bringing in, you know, all the different type of restaurant concepts. It was building those restaurant concepts out, and it was working and building the teams in each of the restaurants to really get them right for Dubai. And obviously at that point there wasn't really. I think 2007, it hadn't, that whole celebrity chef thing hadn't really kicked off in Dubai. So we sort of were sort of pioneering that with the likes of Nobu, Giorgio Locatelli, Michelle Rostang, and Santi Santamaria.
They were all part of the original setup.
Those chefs were part of the overall arching all of F&B within the complex. So, you know, and when we kicked off, we didn't kick off slowly, as you probably remember. We were doing on average around 20,000 meals a day.
Wow.
And it was extremely busy time for all of us. You know, end of 2008, the lights went out.
So you just caught it before it all fell off the edge of the cliff.
And, you know, like every crisis, as we're going through every crisis, you need to, and every challenge, you know, we managed the experience of going through SARS in Hong Kong. I was there in 2003 and remembered how quickly that bounced back. 9/11 when I was in the Caribbean and remembered what happened then. I mean, going through what we're going through now is a very different time. And it was almost like, you know, nothing will compare to COVID, because you almost pull everything out and reboot the computer and start again.
We'll go on to that later on, I think, because I think that's worth its own bit, just specifically to talk about that and how damaging and dangerous it has been and likely to be over the next 6-12 months, I guess.
But how bad was 2008 when you compare it to COVID?
Oh, look, it was... how could I say? It's non-comparable to COVID.
Yeah.
I think it was tough. Everybody knew that it was quite difficult, a difficult time, but it was manageable.
Yeah, right.
Nothing like now.
You still had events, you had mass gatherings, albeit, you know, slightly less infrequently, but people were still
numbers.
You still have entertainment, you still have everything. It was just a challenging time for a short period.
Sure.
But, I mean, like any challenge, you're going to face it head on.
Yeah.
You find solutions, you find ways of being able to adapt your business to be more flexible and malleable. And you become stronger and better, you know. I mean, I always see that, you know, being in environments like, say, Barbados, where all the European ingredients, because of BSB, because of mad cow disease and dairy and all those issues, so all of that part of the world, we couldn't get any of those products into the Caribbean. Right.
Nothing like that.
So, you know, I was on a plane to America the next following week, and I was trying to find all the products out of the US and the rest of the world, and you've just got to find ways of being able to manage through those situations.
And of course, I mean, where you're coming from, you're always thinking about what's the next thing. And I remember a good few years ago when they let you loose into America and to the UK to go and check out gastropubs, all of those kind of things. So I get what I'm saying is that Atlantis was very good because they gave you a lot of breathing space to be able to think strategically about what the next thing is and how that you're going to bring that back to Dubai.
Yeah, look, I mean, we're working with Seoul was amazing. I mean, I always say that when you're working with visionary people in the industry, and I've been very fortunate in my career to work with amazing visionary people, you know, the likes of Dermot, the likes of Jean-Luc, the likes of Seoul. You know, look, when you have an entrepreneurial spirit and you have vision and you believe in
and you've done your strategic work on what you're trying to plan. I mean, one thing with Atlantis, when I turned up, I realized there was no casual dining for anyway besides the two buffets.
Right.
So, you know, I remember I used to have breakfast with Mr. Kersner every time he used to come. He'd like to have a conversation with me. We got along really well. And he asked me how things were going. I said, you know, look, we have some ideas. And I just took him down and showed him a space in the back of the Rostang where we wanted to turn it into the burger joint.
Right. Which was a huge success.
And we thought we were going to do 300 burgers a day. And the first day we did 650, and we're doing 2 tons of potatoes a week. And the guys, and we thought, oh, let's do our own chips. I mean, gosh, I mean, try and do your own French fries. I mean, especially when the potatoes are so different and the seasonality of them. Oh, it's really unique. But it was fun. I mean, look, you couldn't ask for a more engaging, interesting, entrepreneurial type of environment to work. I was walking around banging on walls to see if I could find space to create something more casual.
Right.
And that's when we went over, closed down half of the retail element across the way and put Asia Republic in there and then found another hole in the wall to do the shawarma bar. So, you know, you constantly, you know, look, foods like fashion, F&B industries like that, you're constantly reinventing yourself, you're constantly looking at ways of improving, giving the customer a different experience, and it never stops.
And you were just talking about product. Is it a real challenge to get the produce that you want out here, especially in the summer months particularly?
I think it's only just improved year on year. I mean, I think about the day when, you know, Right Market and some of the hydroponics were starting and some of the vegetable gardens were growing, and back, you know, I'm talking 10 years ago, even longer, where we used to have to buy everything abroad, and then all of a sudden we were able to have this technology to be able to grow here, and that's great.
Sure.
And that's just continuing to grow and
get better.
I mean, look, you know, fancy if you would have said to me, we're actually 10 years ago, we're going to make burrata and Russell Kamer, I would have thought, come on, no way. But, you know, you can't. And then the Dibber Oyster, and you know, you're talking about product that is sustainable, it's here, it's local, we want to use it.
Sure.
And it should be used first and foremost, you know. It's a great thing. As the industry grows, you've got people that are smart in creating something that can use within the hospitality industry, you know. I mean, I got to tell you the story of the two guys I met in Tasmania when I went out there on a trip with Tetsuya, and they were tuna fishermen sitting on a...
Will you just explain who Tetsuya is?
Well, Tetsuya is probably one of the greatest chefs of all time. I mean,
in Sydney?
In Australia, yeah. He had Tetsuya there. Still has. I believe he is coming out to Dubai at some point. An amazing man. And he started the crossbreed of the brook trout and the Atlantic salmon down in Tasmania and created the Patuna salmon.
Mm-hmm.
And a big doyman of creating like a product that is just regionally and locally grown, sustainable. And we had a big trip down in Tasmania once, and he introduced me to these two tuna fishermen that had a bit of land and decided to grow truffles, you know.
Because they had a lot of oak trees on it.
Yeah, they had some old oak trees, and then they were sitting in the back of the tuna boat, and they looked at each other and said, like, let's grow truffles on our way.
So how did they do that? Did they get the spores from Italy or France?
Yeah. And then they started cultivating from a very small group of oak, and then from there just grew it and then got another plot of land on another side in near Mount Wellington, I believe it was, in Tasmania. And then, you know, but the amazing thing was the year I was down there, I remember that they're probably cultivating about 110 kilos of these black truffles that were the quality of France, if not better, and one buyer, you know. They only had to do one receipt.
In China or Japan or something, I guess. In Hong Kong.
There we go. Yeah, for sure.
And it's annual.
That's one. That's one season.
You're right.
And they'll probably grow.
Well, summer and winter.
Okay.
But generally, at that point, it was the opposite to the summer truffle in Europe. So
perfect.
it was perfect timing.
Yeah, yeah, right.
So, you know, that's the type of characters that I think that, and the type of individuals that you think, wow, they really created something quite special that sort of stuck with me, always has.
Yeah.
Wow, that is amazing. I love it. And presumably they're making a lot more of it now as well.
Oh, I believe so. I mean, I haven't been back. This is a while back. I mean, I was talking 2000, maybe 7 or 8 when I was down there. That's amazing, amazing. But look, I think Dubai is, from a hospitality sort of powerhouse today. I mean, after leaving Atlantis after 10 plus years and moving to London, and then we just wanted to come back because
sure.
I think it's an amazing city.
Can you tell me why Michelin guides don't cover Dubai? Because, you know, obviously we've got some world-class restaurants, but we never really see any marking, whatever you want to call it. Or
no, well, they've got to come in. Well, Michelin always start with, as a gatekeeper is a 3-star. So with a Michelin guide, the gatekeeper is always a 3-star. You have to have at least one in town. Not to say that potentially we wouldn't have a 3-star, but the value, the cost to create a 3-star is absolutely astronomical. I mean, I believe going back a few years, a 2-star, before you've actually eaten anything, it's cost the company about £150 before you actually start eating anything. Value of everything to do with it. So it's an expensive bit out. I think Michelin, after going into Asia, and you know, and I was quite lucky to have spent some time with Jean-Luc and Alain and the team as they went and they started their review of Asia. And this is going back in 2005, 2006. Hong Kong could have started the book because they had Lisboa, they had Rubichon 3-star, which was clearly ready to go.
Mm.
So I think, look, Michelin's a great barometer, but I think there's other barometers out there that can, like the San Pellegrino Top 100, which I think is just as good, if not better.
Well, there were two from Dubai, if I remember right, a few years back.
Well, Zuma was always in about the top 100.
And Le Petit Maison.
And Le Petit Maison.
And the interesting thing with those two is that there are other Zumas, say, in London and in France and in Le Petit Maison. Mm. They didn't get into the top 50, but those two did from Dubai. So that's a brilliant thing.
Well, that's the credit to the people that ran them here.
Yeah.
And when you look at the likes of who was running those restaurants and you look at the names of who they were, well, that's the reason why.
Okay.
You know, it's bricks and mortar, but it comes down to the people, right? It's always the individuals to put their heart and soul and passion into anything that's going to make it great. Greatness doesn't come from coincidence.
Yeah, right.
It's a conscious choice, right?
Yeah.
So, you have to be consistent on what you deliver. And I think, you know, customers are looking for a really different thing than a Michelin restaurant today as well. I think customers aren't looking for that anymore.
It's more casual for starters.
Well, they're looking for something that's a lot more relaxed, engaged. There's a lot more around the food, where it's from, the narrative of the food, how is it grown. You know, there's a lot about health, of course. It continues to be there. I think, you know, plant-based, keto diets, all these type of elements of our industry now are quite important. But I think also too, it's the how the customer feels. Like, how do you feel? Do you feel like you belong? You know, it's like, it's a lot more, it's more residential, it's more local. You see the likes of the smaller restaurants.
Three Fills, great example.
Yeah.
So I'm going to turn the tables on you. Where's your interest lie in culinary? Where do you like to go, or what do you like to eat?
Wow. I mean, look, I've always loved Asian food. I've always, you know, look, I like restaurants like that are quite that are residential. Lola's is a prime example. I mean, we just opened with the first group, Lola's Spanish Tavern down at Trip, and Antonio and the team had El Sur. I don't know if you remember that back at the Western back in the day.
It was great.
And Loy and Danny and the team were there. And I, you know, now that I'm heading up all the food and beverage for the first group, we spoke to Antonio at Sunset, and I knew that he was looking for a location to do another Spanish restaurant, and it was the old Barbary site.
Right.
And as soon as we walked in, he just said, "Wow, this is going to make an amazing taverna." So I love that real, honest, authentic food. I think if it's true, it's true to itself. I think it wins every time. You know? Quality will shine through.
Mm.
So, and you know, as we're moving on with the restaurants, we're thinking smaller, more. I think, you know, everything in Dubai has always been very big and very
sure.
brash, which has its reference, but it's actually a lot smaller, residential, more communal, community-based, something where people can come just for a, you know, for a quick glass and a yeah. little bite and a nibble and feel like they're coming somewhere.
Yeah.
I think, as you know, we're all a big fan of Luke and what he's done at
yeah.
Lala and Little House, and it's a prime example of having great
yeah.
a great community with
yeah.
and it, but it takes a great leader to be able to do that.
Sure.
So, you know, that's where I think we're heading, and I think it's where we're probably our focus is going to be on, you know, for some time to come. I think it's an interesting time for all of us, especially during this COVID period.
Right.
I think food and beverage will come out in the end.
Yeah.
Can't wait to get the entertainment back because it does make a big difference.
Exactly. And I mean, exactly. you've seen it over the last 12 months, Jeffy. Mm. I mean, it's been devastating to the industry. You know, have many places managed to hold on, or have many gone down? I mean, you'd hope that they would have just done enough to keep the lights on, and the good ones will always survive, I hope.
I think talking to the business and looking at it, I think on average, I think we lost about 35 to 40% of all restaurants.
Wow.
Around 30 to 35% won't open or will ever reopen.
Wow.
You know, look, I go back to 2006, 2007. We had 2,500 restaurants in this town.
Mm.
When I left in 2017, we had close to 10,500.
Okay.
Back in 2 years later, it was almost 12,500.
Wow.
So you've got to think about, we also only have a demographic of 500,000 customers that consume F&B.
Mm.
In this town. It's not like London. Central London has 8.5 million.
Mm.
Central London.
Mm.
Central London has about the same amount of restaurants as all of the UAE. So when you put it in comparison, you think the volume and the amount. So of course there's going to be people that, you know, there's outlets that, you know, come and go.
Yeah.
I think the big challenge here is you can't be rinse and repeat. And what's happened here is you have rinse and repeat restaurants that just pop up, and it's sure. just a repeat on something else you've seen that looks a bit the same but doesn't do...
Copy-paste.
It's copy-paste.
Mm.
And I think the uniqueness of what we need to do in the town, I think it's happening as well.
It's to be innovative.
New idea.
It's to be authentic.
Yeah.
If you're going to be authentic.
Yeah,
but don't make it difficult for the customer either. Don't make it.
Mm.
It can't be brain surgery.
No, right.
You know, it can't be that it becomes too, you know, yeah. too difficult. It has to be good and be delivered.
Community.
You know.
So when's you hope that it will start to pick up gradually yeah. over the next 3-6 months?
Look, fingers crossed. I mean, we're always positive. I think that, you know, the government has done an amazing job on where we are today, and I think that time will only tell. We have to just keep moving on. Be positive, and hope that we can see light at the end of the tunnel.
Sure.
I think, you know, look, let's say, what's going to happen in summer if everyone's able to travel again and come back? And
well, hopefully flights are opening up more, as we talked about, and just green shoots.
And then from there, we'll come out of it. And I think certain parts of the restrictions will remain for some time.
Mm.
That's my gut feeling. Then, and I think the day of the buffet is over. for some time. It might become sexy again, Rex, but it may be a little bit of time we need
to wait about it.
No, it might not be, but at one point in time it will come back. It's like anything. It's like afternoon tea. You know, afternoon tea probably 10 years ago wasn't, but it is now.
Well, that's a nice segue back to London, isn't it? So when you left in 2017...
I went to Harrods.
You went to Harrods, and what were you doing there?
I was general manager of all restaurants and food halls. So I looked after the operation in London. Amazing operation. It's phenomenal.
I mean, footfall, you were taking
45,000 people a day. If you moved something, if you made a decision on something in the day, in the
morning,
say, I'm going to move that from there and see how it goes, you know, in 1 hour if you've done the right thing or not. You'll know. But just the volume, the sheer volume. I mean, when we opened the Roast and Bake Hall and we had the 34-seat coffee bar, 34 seats, we're doing 14 turns a day. At one point in time, you have to sort of ask that we have to put a little sign that says, after your 45 minutes, you have to vacate the seat or we start charging you, I think it was £35 an hour.
Right.
But people were paying it.
Yeah, sure.
And then they were just buying more coffee. So it was, and we'd have a queue all the way around, and then all the people in the retail side were getting angry because all these people were lining up to sit in the coffee bar.
And were these people from London or tourists coming?
Tourists. I mean, especially in the food halls. But then we had all the restaurants throughout the whole building. You know? So we had the amazing Georgian restaurant, which was there from 1906 or something on the fourth floor. And I think it was Mr. Fayed's very famous restaurant with old tablecloths and the Garadon trolleys, and the old boys used to wheel out the Dover sole and carve it, and everything would take time. And it was what was probably Harrods back in the 50s and the 60s.
Well, that brings up a point. Did you hit many walls as an innovation?
It was actually because we were adjacencing all the different floors at the same time. We had to close the tea rooms downstairs on the second. So we had a bright spark idea that why don't we just move the tea rooms to the George and take the tablecloths off.
Shock
the
horror.
Shock horror. We're going to change the name. And turning up to the board and asking to change the name was an interesting time. but we got it through, and literally it took 2 to 3 weeks, and we're doing nine turns.
On how many covers?
220. And lifts that I'd never seen open before started to open because we sent the adjacencies differently downstairs and sent people to the tea rooms to the fourth floor. And, you know, we put this beautiful big table there with all the patisserie. We had the most amazing pastry chef and bakers. And we thought, we put an ambient table there. That ambient table, the money that used to make was phenomenal, just all day. People coming up and making the cakes and the afternoon tea. I won't tell you what we had in 17 for a wedding. That was big. I think 17 or 18 when Harry and Megan get married. We had a special afternoon tea for the wedding.
Quite topical at the moment.
Very topical. Mm. Very topical.
Mm. A bit of a moot point, actually. Anyway.
But it was an amazing operation. Pizzas flying. I've got to tell you that we had one of the most amazing pizza chefs I've ever worked with, Giuseppe, and he'd been there for like 25 years and was hired directly by Mr. Fayed. And the stories he used to say about the store and one was that when I turned up on a Friday, I went upstairs and there was a guy that was standing, a chef that I'd never seen before. He's standing there with a uniform. And all of a sudden, he starts to sing opera. So all of a sudden, he's spinning pizzas and he starts to belt out opera songs. And it was like everybody stops and listens. And Giuseppe tells me the story of how it all started. And he said, well, the guy actually cleans all the deep fryer oil in the building. He's the guy that sucks all the deep fry oil and regenerates and then puts back in the deep fryers. And he's been here for like about 15 years. And then one day they were doing a walkthrough because Mr. Fayed, and they still do a full shop walkthrough, and they check everything. And they're on the second floor and they're coming up to the pizza aisle and they see this guy fumbling around with these cans of oil, and he knocks a can of oil over, and the whole oil goes down the back fire escape stairs. Well, instead of swearing and carrying on, he breaks out in opera songs. So he starts singing opera at the top of his voice, not realizing that about 3 meters behind him was the whole senior management of Harrods, including Mr. Fayed, watching him. And Giuseppe says, Mr. Fayed turned to me and said, Giuseppe, I have an idea. Get him to sing in the Pizziola. So about a week or 2 weeks later, he got him up there. And Giuseppe says the story, and it's hilarious. He says, Mr. Fayed, I'm going to do it. I said, should I tell him I'm going to do it today? He said, I'm not going to tell him I'm doing it. I'm just going to do it. So I got Andy, he gave him some pizza dough, and he started singing. Well, what happened was total panamania. Everybody stopped. All the customers stopped on the floor, and they all flocked to the pizziola to hear this guy sing. And at that point in time, there was security everywhere. Security didn't know what was going on.
Yeah.
And Mr. Fayed had to come down, and Giuseppe was there. And he said, I tell you what, I think we're on a winner here.
This was your idea.
Yeah. So, you know, our industry is fantastic.
Yeah.
We wouldn't do anything else. I think that we're very lucky in Dubai. We have some amazing restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
I think and the next year or so is going to be a very interesting time for us. We have to be quite we have to just get better.
Mm-hmm.
It's like anything. You just get better at what you deliver to the customer.
And for you, that means obviously keeping innovating, doing all the good things. And there's a lot for you to do, to look forward to as well.
Oh, absolutely. You know, heading up the first group has been great since, well, I joined the team during COVID. So it was, and we literally rebooted the computer and started from scratch. And it's been wonderful. You know, we're opening Lola's. We're about to open Ikigai with Reef, Chef Reef. Over in the Millennium Place Hotel.
And what is that? Is that Japanese or
Japanese street?
Yeah.
It's going to be actually izakaya concept. So beverage and food led, very innovative, and very exciting times. You know, and then from there we open a fabulous property in JVC. And we'll have a Latin American concept and Cuban cigar lounge there, along with a Mediterranean restaurant and pool club on the third floor. So really interesting times for us as we move on.
Perfect. And
we've got more properties opening over in Business Bay later in the year. So, look, it's I think that it is always still going to be challenging for a lot of hospitality operations in town. But I think it's just a matter of managing through this period of time and just getting your product better and better. It's the time to do it.
Great. Well, we've pretty covered everything from A to Z, haven't we?
Well, I'm pretty hungry now.
You know, you got me very hungry.
Yeah. No, that's amazing.
Jeffy, thank you very much for your time, mate. It's been fascinating having you on.
Yeah, Captain, no, thank you Rex, so much.
It's a pleasure to be here.
You're a
champion. Can't wait to see you.
Thank you so much.
Again.
Cheers.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Bye.
Cheers.